You may be getting a little tired of all of the rain that has fallen. Now, it looks like we might be into a little drier period here, at least for a few days. We'll take a look at the months of May and June with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Steve, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, good to have you back.
It's great to be back.
And John Martin, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. John, good to see you again.
Yeah, good to see you, Larry.
Well, how has the rain affected your area of the state? Maybe you have some questions about severe weather. We're kind of getting into that part of the year as well. I hope you'll join in our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Love to hear from you. Well, let's talk about all that rain. What's causing all the rain that we've had? And, you know, I was in Stevens Point on the weekend. They said, well, it hasn't been too bad here. We've had rain, but not to the extent that the southern part of the state has had. And then the far north.
I was just going to say, I think if you took testimony from a sort of randomly selected group of Wisconsinites, you might get different stories over the last couple of weeks, because some places probably haven't felt it's been unusual at all, and others have been inundated quite literally. So it's just been one of those periods of time since really about mid-May, in my opinion, maybe even early May, where we've had a bit of a target on our back in various parts of the state, where every time there's a chance for a convective activity to blow up, it's done so, and it's done so in a healthy way, and it's been very heavy precipitation. Some of that's related to interaction with the tropics, but that's not unusual interaction. Yeah. It's just episodic. It doesn't happen every year in quite the same way, but it's been a pretty exciting mid-May to late June.
Yeah, and the far north, that really, they've been getting so much rain, and it comes in a very short period of time,
yeah,
too.
Yeah,
it's caused a lot of damage in northern Wisconsin, northern Michigan.
Yeah, and when it comes in that situation, when the ground is already wet, it can't, you know, be absorbed by the ground, yeah. And so it runs over and does a lot of damage.
Yeah, the damage is compounded exactly by that reason.
What do you have any data on the stats, statistics about rainfall in May and June?
This past May, we were above normal. I think we almost got twice than what we climatologically will get. And this June so far, we're like 50% above normal in terms of rainfall amount. And it's come in heavy stuff, but then even between, we'd get light precipitation.
You know, yeah.
Just enough to keep us from cutting the lawn.
Right. I think it was especially true at least in Madison last week. We had the very heavy Saturday and Sunday rains, and then, or maybe Sunday and Monday, I forget now the days, but, and then it was a little bit of rain almost every day. You're right. And it just really brings the water table up. My house had, I don't have any leakage coming in from the walls or from windows or anything, but I had a little bit coming up from the water table because the foundation's old, so it's got a crack in it somewhere. But that's an issue in some places that you don't otherwise expect, and that's a function of all this consistent amount of rain that piles up.
Is that trend going to continue?
It looks like the next week or so is going to be intermittent thundery, because we're going to get humid and warm again by the middle to end of this week, and then we may have intermittent thunder showers. But nothing doesn't seem as well organized and as persistently a threat as we've recently had.
Yeah. We've had some high temperatures, pretty high temperatures, too, when it wasn't raining.
Yeah, I think we've had maybe 4 days over 90 already this summer.
Yeah, we did. And so, I think in May in particular, aren't they looking for record stretches of 90-degree weather?
We never had four straight in the month of May we did right around Memorial Day. Yeah, so it's been an unusually warm kind of tropical feeling summer thus far.
Yep. Well, it certainly brings up to mind climate change. What's going on with funding for climate change outreach and education?
Well, there was recently a report that four Republican senators decided that they, in the United States Senate, decided that they wanted to write a letter to the Inspector General of the National Science Foundation, which really is the gold standard of research and especially peer-reviewed proposal writing. You don't get proposals accepted to the NSF by simply writing code words into them the way that some of these people would have you believe. I was 0 for 5 last summer, and I hope to do a little better this summer. And that was without code words. Maybe I made a mistake. But anyway, they suggested that this program called Climate, I forget what it's called now, Climate Watch or Climate Manager, something like that. Anyway, it's an outreach and education opportunity that the National Science Foundation funds that helps broadcast meteorologists to learn a little bit more on the side about what's going on in climate science, but then also to provide them with opportunities to make contributions while they're talking about their local weather to say, hey, this is the kind of thing that we're keeping our eye on as far as what's happening with the climate. And what these senators are suggesting is that climate change generally is a partisan activity, and therefore it shouldn't be funded by the National Science Foundation. And really what they've done is they've created a controversy that suggests, they've asserted that it's a partisan activity, and then based on that assertion, they've said we can't fund partisan activities. It's ludicrous. It's very unfair.
So what effect does that defunding have on the conversation on climate change then?
Well, I think in this particular example, you know, most people from the public, their interactions with scientists is through their local weather forecaster.
Right.
And so it's really critical that they understand the atmospheric sciences in general and climate in particular. And so I think in that sense, you know, they're taking away that education opportunity. I mean, taking away education and science out of decision making is just...
It's never a good idea.
A good thing for society.
Right. And as Steve points out, this is the way in which I think people have their most frequent and familiar contact with the physical sciences broadly is through their broadcast meteorology that they get on television or the radio. And to not take advantage of that to educate about what we're learning about the climate system is really, really terrible. And then to base that withholding of funding on some specious argument that this is a partisan activity, suggesting the science itself is agenda-based and partisan, is ludicrous.
We are visiting with our weather guys today, John Martin and Steve Ackerman from the UW. Great to have them along. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call or email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's take a call. Mary in La Crosse, it's your turn. Mary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I have two glass tubular hummingbird feeders at my apartment, and I've had them for years, and I keep them really clean because I love my hummingbirds, so I'm always putting fresh sugar water in them. But I have noticed over the years that the water level changes, and I'll notice that it's kind of empty, doesn't look like there's water in the tube, but then I'll check and there is water in there, but then it'll raise up actually quite a bit. And so have I created, or is that kind of like, what would it be called? Is that a barometer or something that, what is changing the water level in my hummingbird feeders?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, that is an interesting...
Yeah, I don't know exactly how they work, Mary, but if they have one open end and then a basin in which the water is, they definitely would act like a barometer. There's no doubt about it. I don't know how much... I think there's water is really a deep column of water that reacts, right?
Water, right?
So
yeah.
that would mean you get a pretty good reaction in a small sort of segmented piece of it. When the pressure rises and falls.
Yeah,
it could very well be.
Yeah, I would recommend getting a barometer. You can get relatively cheap ones, and then making those observations just, you know, in terms of what is the pressure and then whether or not you noticed it go up or go down and see if there is a correlation.
That'd be a really good idea.
That's a great idea. How does this whole business of barometric pressure, just to explain how that, going on there?
The atmosphere has mass, so, you know, if you put a bunch of atmosphere into a box or something, it actually, that box will weigh something because there's air in it. And so if you and every day there's air coming into and out of air columns that are sitting above us based on the dynamics of the atmosphere. And so the pressure that's measured at the bottom of that column of atmosphere is going to fluctuate quite dramatically from day to day. And that's why if you have a measurement that you can take, you can actually see that fluctuation, and it's sometimes fairly dramatic.
Yeah, that's really cool. So get yourself an inexpensive, and they don't cost a few bucks.
And you know what, the pressure is relatively uniform over an area, so you could probably even just use, you know, the local National Weather Service one.
Oh yeah, the one on the phone call or something.
Right,
that's right.
You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions or comments. And let's see, we have Richard in Eagle, Wisconsin. So let's go right there. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I thank you so much for this program. I live within 1 mile of the intersection of Waukesha, Walworth, and Jefferson counties. And I have a very strong interest in meteorology since I was a kid. And I'd like to know if your guest could suggest to me a professional quality weather station so that I might be able to download my local data to the Sullivan facility. I very much would like to contribute my weather data on a daily basis and also be a severe weather spotter as well. So a suggestion would be appreciated.
Sure.
And I thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks a lot.
So the National Weather Service routinely runs severe weather training activities, particularly this past month, because we were entering severe weather. So you might contact the National Weather Service Sullivan office or the Green Bay office to see when they're doing their spotting, for sure. And then, the station that I have, I got a number of years ago, the home weather station, I think was made by a company called Oregon.
Oregon Scientific.
Yeah, Oregon Scientific.
Taylor Instruments or Taylor Scientific has a good one, too, but the Oregon is a good one. Yeah, that's right.
And I would recommend, going online. That's what I did. I just asked a bunch of people about, what do they have and how do they like it, and that drove me to get in the Oregon.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then to be a severe weather spotter, there's some training involved?
Yeah, that's the training involved with that. And then if you go to that training, then the National Weather Service folks will probably also be able to tell you how to join the co-op, because there are a lot of co-op observations that are used.
So there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Lots of callers online. We'll get to you. Our guests today, John Martin, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW. Steve Ackerman, he's also a professor there and director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. And as I look at my screen here, I see there's like one open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. We'll be back with our guests right after this look at the news, so you stay with us. Lots more in store here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at climate and weather with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Steve also directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at the UW. Weather, climate questions for them, or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Let's go to the phones again. Joel in Milwaukee, you're up first. Thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Yes. In my experience, it seems like it rains more frequently in the evening and night than during the day. So is that the two weather guys? What does the science say about why it, about does it rain more often in the evening at night? I'd like to know why.
Okay. Is that the case? And
I think in the summertime you'll see that, because in the summertime our precipitation is driven by convection. And largely that get kicked off by solar heating. So a lot of times storms will begin in midday and then carry into the evening time. But in the winter time, when our storms are really, the precipitation is driven by larger scale synoptic type storms. I don't know if there really is a day-night difference.
I don't think there's much of a diurnal spike in that time of year. You're right. It's more of a summertime one. Yeah.
I was thinking about my time I spent a year at the University of the West Indies in Trinidad, and there those clouds would kind of stack up overnight against the mountains. and then come over, and then you get the rain in the day.
Mm. I wonder if there's a different circulation or something because of the orography, and you're in the tropics and
yeah.
stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the diurnal, which is the day-night differences, is really driven by geographical regions as yeah. well. So in the mountains in, you know, Colorado, for example,
yeah.
the thunderstorms start in the mountains during early mid-afternoon, and then move out onto the yeah. plain. So you really see that diurnal cycle.
Yeah.
Whereas over the tropical oceans, it's the other way around. It's the nighttime air sinks, and that's mm-hmm. what tends to help drive thunderstorms.
Yeah.
Let's go to, thanks again, Joel, for calling. Appreciate it. Joel, Gary in West Salem, your turn now. Hi, Gary.
Hi. You guys have a tremendous show, and I enjoy listening. I don't get a chance as often as I'd like. But my question would be, I live near La Crosse, and we have two active TV stations here, as well as United States Weather Bureau. And my question is, it seems like the forecast that comes from one, the two TV stations, varies from that of the United States Weather Bureau, and sometimes is not even close, and I'm wondering why.
Hmm. Hmm. That's a... surprising turn of events, but you know, it may well be the case. One of the things that characterizes the broadcast forecast, I think, is that it tends to be a little bit more detailed than what you might get from the Weather Service. Weather Service has a purview to do well across a whole region of the state, whereas your local broadcaster, especially in a place like La Crosse where there's topography and various other things going on, might try to tailor it a little bit and get a little more specific and then occasionally miss. So I wonder if that's not the part of the underlying reason that it sticks out in your mind, that you tend to take the broadcast forecast with a little bit more of a grain of salt because they might be trying to get too specific and sometimes don't get it right.
Yeah, that could well be. That makes a little bit of sense to me.
I guess I was thinking, I guess it's consistent. I was thinking that the local forecast would be better because they're so familiar with the geography of the regions and the climate of the regions. But maybe that's making them.
And they might actually be better, except at the time when
they're wrong, you really remember.
Yeah, you might, you know, again, getting to the specificity, if you're really specific and you have an assertion that the weather's going to be fine and it's not, you remember that. And Weather Service may have been vague on such a day, and you wouldn't really hold them quite as accountable. I don't know.
I don't know.
Well, we have some. I'm thinking about the Madison weather people. We have pretty,
I think
darn
that's,
good people here, professional people.
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking of when he was asking the question. That we got some really good forecasting in this area. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that popped in my mind that I wonder if it's different between. What we have in Madison versus La Crosse is that La Crosse also has the National Weather Service right there. So maybe they're really familiar as well with the local conditions.
That could be. Weather. That's an excellent point. Yeah. They may have a little bit more local flavor, even though it's a regional
then,
purview.
Like Sullivan, even though the Southern forecast is really good, they're still 90 miles away or something.
That's right.
That makes sense. I was just saying, it was kind of sad. Karen Swanson isn't going to be leaving.
She's working for Clean Lakes, I think, or something. She wrote to me
really?
And told me that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry to see her go. I always enjoy her weather forecast. But actually, all of them
are really good.
All of them are really, really good. Gary, thanks so much. Appreciate your call. Len in Cross Plains, it's your turn. Hi, Len.
Hi. My father, who passed away many years ago, so I won't be embarrassing him, used to say that an electrical storm added nitrogen to the soil. Any truth to that?
Oh, that's a good question. Lightning strikes will generate nitrogen. Whether it gets into the soil or the atmosphere, I'm not sure.
Yeah, me either. I was on a research aircraft once when we were in kind of the middle of an event with lightning, and hydrogen cyanide is produced by the lightning, and that's kind of a proto-organic chemical. Yeah. But I don't know about nitrogen getting in the soil.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff that goes on that's very, you know, organic that has to do with lightning. So it wouldn't surprise me, but I don't know.
And there's a new lightning sensor up there, so that might help us do monitoring of the lightning frequency and things like that. So that might help answer those questions.
I wonder if lightning struck the soil.
Well, I was wondering that, too, that it might push it in that way. Mm-hmm. Or even if you just generate more nitrogen, the fluxes, there's always... fluxes of energy and gases between the ground and the atmosphere up above. So
I can remember as a kid, I was at a friend's house and looking out across the fields, a rainstorm, and there was a plowed field, and the lightning bolts struck the middle of that field in the ground, and things kind of flew a little bit.
Very awesome. Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen that.
I was glad I wasn't out there. Yeah. That's for sure.
We saw some, didn't see it happen, but we were at my folks' house who lived on Long Island, and there was this mud all over the side of their house, and my dad was trying to figure out what happened. And so we're looking at it, and then I looked down on the grass, and it was just like this dead line of grass. Just went out, you know, to about 10 yards away, and then right there it was a hole, and I was like, oh yeah, you probably got hit by lightning. And they just, you know,
I've seen them on golf courses, but not at the time it happened. You know, you can see those,
you
kind
can
of
see the dead grass,
right, streaky dead grass out, and maybe a little divot. Yeah, really interesting.
So then it's still up in the air a little bit here. We're not,
yeah, but we'll check that
sure
out, because that's a really good question.
Yeah.
Well, they're all really good questions.
Well, Steve's going to check that out, and we'll have a report the next time they're on, which is July 30th, as a matter of fact. So stay listening. Let's go to Tim and Nina next. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I just wanted to follow up on the variation in local forecasting. I'm a kayaker, and I'm off of Lake Winnebago. And I also notice, even on Lake Michigan, there'll be a wind forecast, and a lot of times that forecast isn't only off, it's off by 180 degrees. Mm. Is there any way to discern, you know, what you get in a forecast so you can kind of predict what the weather is? You go someplace, and instead of having the wind one way, you've got a 2.5-foot sea coming at you. So I was just curious about the variation around our Lake Winnebago, per se, and sometimes even on the big lake.
Yeah.
Yeah. My guess is that, is this the Weather Service again, maybe, that you're referring to that gives a forecast?
No, I used to be a cross-country ski racer, and it was important for temperatures there. I would monitor all the local weather channels and write them down and see who was the closest, not who was the most popular, and then take the one that was closest for temperature and humidity for wax.
Yeah.
Now that I paddle, you know, I'm trying to pick a wind so I don't get out over my head.
Yeah.
They just don't be able to, they just don't seem to be able to forecaster on Lake Winnebago specifically at all. They're off 180 degrees more than they're on.
Yeah, I would, you know, I grew up in New England, and a lot of times you'd get two forecasts of wind almost all the time. Maybe this is true in Long Island, too. You'd get the forecast for the broad conditions around the area, and then you'd get the forecast for maritime issues. And, you know, that's where you'd get your small craft advisories or some other stuff like that. And I wonder if some of the places around the lake are just, unfortunately, it sounds, perhaps less sensitive to making those kinds of distinctions, because there really is a huge variation in local winds around big bodies of water. And you're right to pick on both Lake Winnebago and the bigger lake. They can have really important local wind circulations that are also modulated by the topography. The exact nature of the land-sea interface is a big deal. And maybe some of the sources are just not paying any attention to that and leaving you out in the cold. In a way that can be dangerous. Could be that. I don't know.
Then the other thing that comes to my mind, because being off by 180 degrees a lot of times makes me wonder, reminding that a north wind is going to the north, not coming from the north.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's
right. Yeah, it's going to the north,
not coming from the north.
Yeah, and that's just convention,
Right, yeah, that's just convention. But yeah, forecasting around large lakes, winds is pretty tough because you have the heating difference, which is going to change depending on time of day and what the sun is up and what that's doing. And then you have frictional changes. So as soon as the wind comes over the big lake like that, it's going to change directions just because the friction goes down.
Yeah, that's right.
There you go, Tim. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jerry in Milwaukee and Gary in Iron River both say the changing levels in the hummingbird feeders are caused by heating of the air in the feeder expanding and pushing more fluid down into the feeder and sometimes overflowing it and then sucking it back up when the temperature goes down.
That sounds like a good idea.
It could very well be they're probably right on about that. I don't know how the things develop, but
It is kind of closed. I'm thinking of the hummingbird feeder that we used to have, and it is kind of closed off, so that air inside is going to get
out. I see it's a closed off
thing. Cylinder.
Okay, so that makes a lot of sense. And Jerry
but
and
I'd
Gary,
still do the experiment.
So would I.
Still would, too.
It would be really interesting.
I would as well. Let's go to Richard and Ettrick next. Hi, Richard.
Hey, how you doing? Great show, Larry.
Thank you.
I farm, and one of the things I struggle with is trying to make hay here this month. And I'll go to four different sites, and every one of them is pretty much different. So what's a good agricultural weather forecast site that I can use?
So when you're looking at agriculture, are you looking at precipitation?
Right. I'm looking for a 72-hour window with some with a high degree of accuracy, you know, like for cutting hay.
Yeah. You know? Boy, I'm afraid to even think of one just because precipitation is probably the toughest thing to forecast.
Yeah, it sure is. I don't know the answer to that. I can only tell you a story. It's not going to be very satisfying. But one of my graduate students, who's now a world-famous scientist, works in Steve's group downstairs at Sims, does data assimilation. But he grew up on a farm in Minnesota, and he came to graduate school here with the desire to start an agricultural forecast company for primarily for this reason, making those kinds of forecasts, 48 to 96-hour forecasts for these very farm-specific utilities. Because that was one of the things he specifically mentioned to me when he first came to interview was, you know, we don't know when to cut hay because we need 3 days of dry, and if we don't get it, we you know, compromise the product and whatnot. So it's been a long-standing issue, and I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
And so he never got...
No, he does other things now. He's going to get his PhD from University of Reading. Really great scientist, but he didn't
go back
to... He
works on flash droughts now.
Yeah.
You know, droughts that develop really quickly.
He went the other way.
Yeah, he did. He wants it to always be really dry.
There we go.
Sorry about that.
Richard, though, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Cindy in Belleville, it's your turn. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, thanks, Larry. This wasn't my original question, but I hear you, Richard. My first cutting of hay was a total loss that got rained on twice. But my question, with regards to all of our excess rain lately, I've been keeping an eye on the Synopsis chart, trying to predict when to cut hay, and have been noticing how lately we seem to have lots of stationary fronts that stall out near or over the top of us and then just kind of sit there and wiggle back and forth, so the forecast becomes problematic to make an accurate guess as to when we'll get some rain. And that's unlike our normal pattern where we have a cold front that pushes its way through every, you know, four to five days or so. And I'm wondering why these stationary fronts are parking themselves over us, and why do we have this a lack of forcing to push things through like the normal pattern we see?
Yeah, we're in a climatological transition period of the year right now, which is a really good question you're asking. When you get to early May, you still get visited by frequent synoptic weather systems, the kind that come along with well-developed fronts and progress through the area within a periodicity of about 4 or 5 days. By the time we get to the end of June, and it'll be like this until probably mid to late August, those systems are developing and propagating around the globe at a much higher latitude. So we don't see the progression, the steady progression of weather systems quite like we did all through the cold season and the early part of the spring. So that makes it really hot. It compounds the problem of forecasting precipitation, because Steve mentioned earlier that so much of our precipitation in the summertime comes from the sprouting of afternoon thunderstorms and evening thunderstorms. And they are sometimes not connected to these weather systems with their fronts. And so it's very difficult for me to feel any confidence at all about the analysis of these stationary fronts, because I think most of the activity, the frontal activity, is farther north in southern Canada now, and it will stay there for a couple of months.
There we go. Thank you, Cindy, for calling. Appreciate it very much. Rod in Weyerhaeuser, your turn. Hi, Rod.
Yeah, thank you, Larry. I just wanted to confirm on one thing, the nitrogen. Yeah, I've always heard that said about the lightning putting nitrogen into the ground from all my dad's different farmers. And also, I wanted to ask questions. Is it true that for years and years and years you heard that the lightning actually strikes from the ground up? Now, if that's the case, my dad used to say, too, that because I scrap and stuff and I get to have some of these big magnets, and he didn't want them around the building. He says that they have a tendency, they're known for years, that people, that these magnets will draw lightning. Well, if they're on the ground, then you wouldn't think that that would be the case, lightning going from the ground to the sky.
I think if you had a chunk of a magnet, a big magnet out on the ground, and then a little ways away, another big chunk of iron, I don't think it would really attract any lightning any more than not attract it in terms of the magnet.
Just the fact that it's iron would attract.
Just the fact that it's metal would do it, because there is a flow of an electron, so that things flow upward, current flows upward from the ground to meet the lightning bolt. to generate the lightning bolt. I'm sorry, the thought leader, I guess.
Yeah.
So the lightning comes up or it goes down?
It can go both ways, but it mostly goes up in terms of the bright strike. If you take a high photographic rate a film, you'll see it go from the ground up. But it can go either way.
All right. Rod, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Anne in Madison emailed to say that about 8:15 last Friday in Middleton, the sun was just this bright, glowing, white, yellow, somewhat liquid-appearing beam coming through the clouds. It was so bright you couldn't look at it. Once it got below the horizon, it was beautiful colors. Any idea what caused this? Can the clouds focus the light into a tight beam?
No, the clouds wouldn't do that. They can make it look like it's doing that focusing because you can see these shafts of light coming out, but that's just like holes in the cloud or separation between two different clouds. But they don't act like a magnifying glass. And generally shouldn't look at the sun directly.
Well,
anyway,
this was at night as the sun was setting, I guess.
Yeah, it was later in the day from the sound of it.
Yeah, maybe it's just that you take away the top and the bottom part of the disc that's a little bit less intense, and all you're seeing is the most intense part, and that really
so
makes it seem like I can't look. It's a contrast
guess
issue, but it's not really a magnification of intensity, like Steve says.
Yeah, she said it was 8:15, so later in the evening. So there we go. Nate in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Nate.
Hi, thank you for having me, and I'm sorry if I'm asking you to revisit the topic too much, but I was going to ask about if you're seeing changes in heavier rains over time. For May and June, because we just had a bunch of rain, and I'm wondering if that's global warming related.
Yeah, so there have been some studies that have been looking at the intensity of rainfall, and they're generally saying that there is an increase in the Great Lakes area for the number of storms with intense rainfall. So it looks like storms are, in terms of precipitation, generally in our area, the change in the amount isn't changing that much, but they're coming in fewer events, which therefore makes them more intense.
And that's consistent with the notion that as the global temperature rises, there's a greater ability and a greater amount of water vapor being held in the atmosphere. And so consequently, it may just be that we get a higher frequency of 2-plus-inch rainfall events as more water vapor is put into a warmer atmosphere. So there's a lot of consistency with that, and it's still in its infant stages trying to really track it down, but it does seem like there might be something to that.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling. I appreciate it. I was looking and seeing that Florida might be, that's the state with the biggest problem regarding climate change in terms of water levels because...
Yeah, I think they got it coming from both sides. They got the sea level rising slowly, and they probably have this exact same thing with the thunderstorm brings a little more rain than it used to. So it's a bad
thing.
They get
a lot of thunderstorms down
there. Yeah, they do. They do. That's right.
Well, Jack in Broadhead called to ask how reliable long-range forecasts are. He's getting married in 2 weeks outside.
Well, I wouldn't cancel the wedding based on our forecast.
But, Jack, don't be using us as an excuse now, Jack. You won't get cold feet because of the temperature, I can tell you that. But, that's hard to say.
It's gotten better and better, but 2 weeks is still a long-term
forecast. In the summertime, it's an eternity, for many of the reasons we've been talking about. You know, the weather systems develop and die within a couple of hours in the summertime. And we're not exactly entering a climatological dry period of the year either. So, you know, it's I hope it works out for you, but it may not.
Jack's probably wondering, do I need to rent a tent? I don't want to spend the money if I don't have to. Oh, my goodness.
Well, you can wait another week and then, you know, wait until you get a 3-4 day forecast and then see, as John is saying, whether or not the synoptic condition.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I would do.
A week is pretty good.
Yeah, by the time you're about a week out, you're either going to know that you run a substantial risk of having a rainy type day or a substantial chance of having it maybe interrupted by a shower, but that's the worst. And that's maybe okay. You can deal with that.
Yeah. So you got to wait another week, Jack.
Yeah, it's a little too far off. But, you know, the old story, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. Keep that in mind.
Oh, and congrats on your wedding, your upcoming wedding. Appreciate it. Well, our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW-Madison, our guests, and I said earlier, they'll be back on July 30th. That's the last Monday in July. Let's see, what do we got coming up tomorrow? Oh, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be back, talk about what to do if your pet is stung by a bee or a wasp. And there are, that happens a lot. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.